Good morning, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on listen-only. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one. I'd like to inform participants that today's call is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Erwin. Sir, you may begin.
All right, thank you, and good morning, everybody. So first of all, I know some of the faces in the room, but certainly not all. My name is Erwin Gyanchanani, and I am the Deputy Division Director for the Division of Computer and Network Systems, CNS, in the SIES Directorate, and it's our pleasure to welcome you to the December SIES Distinguished Lecture. And I want to say a special thank you to all of you in the room, all the folks on the phone, and especially to Mark for your flexibility. This particular talk was originally scheduled back in October. As many of you know, we were overtaken by events then, and so we've had to reschedule, but Mark was very accommodating, and I think that the wait, it will have been well worth the wait by the time we're all said and done. So it's an honor to introduce Mark Hill this morning. Mark is a member of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has been there for much of his career, currently the Gene Omdahl Professor of Computer Sciences, as well as Electrical and Computer Engineering there. He has also taken several sabbaticals at other schools throughout his time, both here in the U.S. and abroad, and had stints in industry at AMD as well as Sun Microsystems, so he has a very well-rounded experience over the course of his career. He is truly a pioneer, a leading figure in the area of computer architecture, and particularly computer systems design and modeling of performance associated with that. He has published extensively in conference proceedings and also is the recipient of a number of awards and honors, including the ACM Special Interest Group on Computer Architecture Distinguished Service Award. He's a member of IEEE, he's a fellow of IEEE and ACM. And most recently, Mark was instrumental, really, in bringing together the computer architecture research community to think through and build consensus around some compelling research directions, particularly in the context of some new and emerging challenges for the 21st century, with new form factors around mobile devices, energy issues associated with that in the cloud, as well as the security and reliability and resilience of this new infrastructure that we have going forward. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mark, but before I do, I was looking at his website last night in preparation for his talk today, and I came across this, which is actually a photograph of his science fair project from sixth grade, I believe?
Ninth grade.
His ninth grade science fair project when he was a student in Detroit. And you can see his ties to computing date all the way back to then. I won't say what year it was, but binary numbers, the secret of modern calculators, and I think it's telling not just how far Mark has come in terms of his visions for the field of computing, but also how far we've come as a community, too. So, Mark, the floor is all yours. Thank you for being here, and we're looking forward to your talk.
Thank you very much, Erwin. Oh, that was a great introduction. I'd like to meet the guy. So it's a pleasure to be here, and please hassle me with questions at any time, because that will be much better than a sort of a one-way talk. This talk has a couple parts. The first part is this white paper that Erwin talked about, so it's sort of very high level and trying to set directions. And then in the second part, I'll try to make a different mistake and get some, you know, real concrete things that you can sink your teeth into. And I'll try to make it as broadly accessible as possible. And I'm going to close with some thank yous to NSF for the support over the years. As Erwin said, this was originally delayed by a government shutdown. You can't really read what it says at the bottom, but it says, if they don't quit complaining, you should threaten them with democracy. Okay, so the first part is on this 21st century computer architecture report, and we're going to go over, like, the process and the key findings having to do with the context, semiconductors, challenges, what computer architecture can do, and why pre-competitive research is justified, I guess, preaching to the choir on that final point. So this was worked on in, with many people providing input. The people in red are those that actually wrote text. So Sarita Adve, Luis Seze, myself, Mary Jane Erwin, David Cayley, Margaret Martinosi, Joseph Torres, Tom Wenich, David Wood, and Kathy Yellick. We had a big run at the end of the alphabet. And then there was guidance from Erwin and Ed Lazowska, Jim Laris, and Jeanette Wing. So we executed this white paper process on a very tight timetable a year ago, where we got together in March, did some brainstorming, used the nine document, which was key to getting things done very fast, and we produced a report by the end of May. And here we're going to go over what the report has. And this had some impact. As some of you may know, the XPS program quotes, first of all, $50 million, and it quotes this report as one of its influences, and also the Game Over study from the National Academy, which I was also involved in. And the program continues this year, so we're very proud of that influence. Of course, the true influence is the results that come out at the end that make things better, but we have to wait more years for that to happen. So part of what this is that, you know, computer and information and communication technology is changing the world, and I don't need to, you know, go into this for this audience, but, you know, 20 years ago, if you wanted to do some research, you started at a library. 10 years ago, a social network was a bunch of people, not something that was electronic, and 5 years ago, tweets came from cartoon characters. And this required innovations all up and down the hardware stack, so let's not try to act like there's a monopoly anywhere. And what this is about is the fact that we have, at the lowest part of the hardware stack, done a lot of innovation where we have intentionally tried to be invisible, right? Because that was a way of dividing and conquering complexity. And so the great thing for that is it made things go fast. The bad thing was is that one didn't often see these innovations. And so some of the key enablers are these cost performance gains from semiconductor technology, most famously Moore's Law, and from computer architecture. And we have a graph on the next slide where some people at Stanford tried to attribute the contributions to this cost effectiveness. And they have technology here and then architecture, more or less equal parts. You can use treat the x-axis as more or less year, and then the y-axis is logarithmic performance. So these are the tremendous innovations that have been happening underneath that make it possible, for example, to, you can do a web search using hundreds of machines, and that gets monetized by the fact that you may or may not click on a link. I mean, what would John von Neumann think of this?
So technology is basically circuits and interconnect silicon?
Well, the technology is, you know, the technology in this graph is basically transistors, semiconductor. But in general, it's been that as well as storage technology and networking technology that have been key. Okay, so we're not over, right? I mean, here's a picture. We're going to do much more than electronic medical records. We're going to do personalized medicine. Scientific discovery is proceeding apace. This is the computing at CERN that helped find the Higgs boson. We need human network analysis. So here is, you can't quite read this New Yorker cartoon, but the grandmother is saying, "You never call. And the federal government will back me up on that." Okay, and there's many, many more things that we're going to do that, you know, if we look at the past history, it was very hard to predict. I mean, some of you in the room remember before the World Wide Web. I do. I mean, I didn't see that coming, and it just exploded. So I think with probability one, there are things like that that we're going to, in 10 years, know that we need that we don't even know about yet. And so rather than try to predict exactly what's going to happen, we looked instead at trying to identify what are the properties that some of these things are going to have. And some of the properties, of course, are the big data, which is really fundamentally changing things, and I don't need to talk more about that. We're much, much more connected. You know, isolated computing is sort of not that interested. You know, if you want to see a teenager look unhappy, you know, let her have a message like that from her phone. We would like to perhaps be more secure and private than we are today. How are we going to do this? Now, one way we can do this is we can just innovate with no cost performance gains underneath, but that is a method we haven't tried yet, right? And so we think there's a lot of merit in trying to keep those cost performance gains happening because they are and enabler of the cool stuff that happens above. Okay, and so this is happening because of technology and architecture. So what's happening with technology? So Moore's Law is the most famous piece of computer technology, and it says that the number of transistors per chip that makes sense sort of doubles every couple years, and that actually can continue for some time, and people debate how long. One of the problems is that its sibling, lesser-known sibling, Dennard scaling, is basically gone. And I'll show you Dennard scaling on the next slide. But basically, this was a technique developed by Robert Dennard and others that says, take this fancy, you know, never mind the details of this transistor, but if you want to make it smaller, how do you make it smaller? Well, you scale everything by a certain ratio, and it still works, and it works better. Okay, and so if you scale everything by a factor alpha, like the voltage goes down by alpha, and the gate width goes down by alpha, et cetera. Alpha is typically the square root of 2 or 1.4. The device works, and it works better. In particular, you get higher density. You get the square root of 2 squared, which is 2. You get twice as many transistors. They're somewhat faster. And importantly, with Dennard scaling, the power per device halved. And so using the higher math of computer architecture, twice as many devices times half the power for each device equals a constant amount of power per chip. And now we were greedy, our chips actually grew in power because we wanted even more transistors. The problem is with Dennard scaling gone, principally because we can't do voltage scaling anymore, what's happening is that you can have twice as many transistors, but oversimplifying a little bit, each device uses the same power. So if you're going to have twice as many transistors, it's going to use twice the power. Well, you know, there are no really good you can go somewhat higher power, but there's no situations that can handle repeated doublings of the power from the phone in your pocket to even a data center. And so something has to give. And, you know, we can have a race to the bottom where we say, well, we're going to not have things that are more, that can do more computing. We'll just make it cheaper to do the same level of computing, or we can do more crazy things. But this is gone. Okay? And let's see. So this is this version 4? Maybe not. Okay. Well, we'll stick with this then. Anyway, so not only is Dennard scaling gone, but there's also lots of other challenges happening from technology. The transistors are getting less reliable. They've always been not perfectly reliable, but we had techniques that used overhead like guard bands or error correcting codes to make it the illusion that computing was perfect. Okay, it's probably not going to be sensible to do that going forward. So we're going to have to go to a regime much more like communication, which has long assumed that things aren't perfect and dealt with it. Now, communication and storage codes work really well because your goal basically is to keep the information unchanged, either over space or time. With computing, it's much harder to protect and make correct without having much larger overheads. Another big factor is that as we scale things down, the efficiency of doing computation scales better than the efficiency of doing communication. And so we're going to have systems that are much more communication dominated. You know, there's counterexamples, like if you want to do a prime number sieve, you can do a lot of computation on a small amount of data. But it's much more common to be streaming a whole bunch of data and doing a little computation on it. And so this is going to make that a dominant factor. And finally, we have two trends that are working against each other. One is that to do more advanced technology, the cost, the one-time cost of building the fab and engineering the chips is going up. Yet on the other hand, we would like to specialize things more because that can make them more efficient for any given situation. And so how do you reconcile wanting to amortize over more sales versus specializing? Okay, so what can architecture do? Okay, so let me just, I want to bring up one more slide, so this isn't quite the right version. Let's just go to slide 34. Oh, here we go. Well, this is a version of the slide. I just wanted to give you another take of this. This is the challenge as viewed by a DARPA ISAT study. Okay, and what it has here is years, and then it has system capability. Think of it as log of system capability. And so what has happened from the technology point of view is that CMOS has sort of plateaued out. And optimists think that, you know, there will be new technologies that will come to replace CMOS and resume this wonderful curve that we've had. And that's happened in the past, so it may happen in the future. The problem is that all the technologies that are out there right now are really in their infancy. They're not really ready to take over. And so we may be faced with this plateau for a long time, or if in this fallow period we can figure out how to squeeze efficiencies of what we got, we can create the illusion of cost performance accruing growing until the new technology kicks in. And so that is a justification for doing this.
Mark?
Yep.
When you say new technology, you mean the CNC-based CPU that was demonstrated by the
I mean, there's carbon nanotubes, there's spin things, there's all kinds of things. I was also on another DARPA ISAT study, which I'm not sure that was made public, but there's all these technologies. They can demonstrate devices, they can occasionally do an ALU, but they don't currently have, they can't do anything cost-effectively enough that anyone would want to use them instead of CMOS. And so they need some way to mature, and they probably need to mature doing something that CMOS is not good at, right? I mean, if you think about how technologies work, flash memory is now able to replace the hard drive in many computers. If that was the original goal of flash memory, it wouldn't have happened, right? Because flash memory went for the small cameras and PDAs and stuff, it got mature enough so it can go. And so all these new technologies to replace CMOS are just not there, and they're going to need A, time, and B, a market that allows them to grow. And it's, you know, they're not, it's not like there's a secret thing there that, you know, in 5 years is going to replace things. It's further out than that. Okay, so what should architecture do? So in the 20th century, oversimplifying a little bit, we worried about a single chip generic computer. So, you know, in the last 30 years, it was designing a microprocessor. Okay? We worked really hard to do all our innovations completely invisible to software, even low-level software. So I don't know if you know this, but, you know, modern chips in a single, they look like they're executing sequential instructions. They could have 50 instructions in flight, just kind of hidden underneath the sheets. Okay? And we did this with technologies that were getting better, but they were getting better in a linear way. So you could predict, if I'm going to ship this in a couple of years, what's going to be the case? CMOS, DRAM, and magnetic hard drives. Okay? So going forward, it's no longer okay to just think about a generic computer. It matters tremendously whether this thing is going to go in a sensor, it's going to go in a handheld, a laptop, or importantly in the cloud. And cloud computers are really important because they are the infrastructure that runs all this cool stuff. And you may be holding this and think about this, but it's the invisible stuff behind that makes so many of these great things possible. And not only are we going to care about performance, but you're also going to want security and privacy, availability, et cetera. Okay, and if you want to learn more about this, here's a nice monograph that I can recommend from the series I edit. And this one is actually free from some people at Google, and they do a nice job arguing that a data center is really a computer, has computation, has storage, it has communication, all of which need to be optimized. Second thing is that because of Dennard scaling, we didn't worry that much about energy. People would design processors to go as fast as possible, and then near the end of the process, squeeze out whatever power they could, and that was their energy solution. Going forward, energy is a first-order design constraint. Parallelism helped. specialization helps. So, for example, if you design more special purpose hardware, you can get easily two orders of magnitude energy efficiency, sometimes three. Okay. These new technologies are coming online. Some of them are a problem, like the less reliable transistors, but there's a lot of opportunity. Non-volatile memory, such as flash and PCM, are for the first time transplanting these technologies that have been around for 30 years. Near threshold is where you run the transistors at a slower, more energy efficient point. 3D chip stacking is a way of getting tremendous bandwidth between chips, and we're going to see this both in a big stack and using a chip as an interposer between multiple other chips. And I will go into it more. And I think this is going to cause us to have to rethink things at many levels. Okay, and then finally, we're talking about cross-cutting. So in the 20th century, things were going fast, getting better fast, to the point where it made sense. You divide and conquer complexity. You have layers. You don't change the interfaces between the layers because that would distract people at other layers. You stay within your layers. And I think an important way we're going to get efficiency back is we're going to occasionally cut through the layers and think about the big picture. So this is an early prototype of something called computational sprinting. And while it doesn't look like it from the prototype, this is an example where you might put this in your cell phone. If you want to do some computation really fast and zippy, but so fast it exceeds the thermal envelope of the cell phone. But it's okay because, one, you do this computation, and then it sits idle for a while. And in the extreme case, these guys are putting some phase change material on top of the chip. So, and you melt the phase change material. And if you remember your high school physics, while you're melting things, the temperature doesn't go up. And so you can sprint for a while. Now, this would have been an absurd idea for the generic computer, okay? But considering the context, it makes a lot of sense. And Farnham's gone, but, you know, one of the guys is Tom Winich at Michigan on this work. All right, so these are the directions that we had in our report, and I realize they're somewhat hand-wavy. That's the nature of these things. And we have some more details in the report, but really the truth of the matter is this is framing the direction for the field in specific research. The specific research will be done by the innovative PIs. And I would like to argue that one of the things is something I'm going to tell you about in the second half of the talk, and this will be an example of the cross-cutting research where we looked at cloud workloads and identified a problem that was not really known, that they were wasting a lot of their time to something, and with a cross-cutting change helped this. Okay, so we think this is justified, and I guess I won't go into this for this audience, but companies can't do this, especially the cross-cutting work that can cross boundaries between companies. I remember years ago I tried to make a case to Microsoft they should fund this research where I wanted to get the operating system out of the way of the network interface. And, you know, it turns out that an operating system company has no interest in getting their software out of the way. Okay, and this report also corroborates other studies, Future of Computing Game Over or Next Level by the National Academy and the DARPA ISAT study. Okay, so this concludes the first part of the talk. Any questions? Yes.
I won't remember exactly, but you really talked about power being the primary consideration. And the discussion of power was really at the processor. And one of the scenarios you talked about was the data center and the computer center. So the question I have is, in that context, is power still a major consideration? And if so, can you broaden your discussion of power a little bit? Because the processor is only one piece and maybe one diminishing piece of that.
Okay, so let me sort of paraphrase the question. So she said that I limited power to the processor, and it's really more than that, especially in the data center. Can you come in the data center? So I did not intend to limit it to the processor. it's the complete problem. You spend, in fact, one of the biggest sources of power are disk systems. If you do a data center, and but at the data center, you know, if you read this monograph by Barroso, it's absolutely all about power. In fact, they're worried about the power that's spent running the air conditioning units, right? Because air conditioning is an unnatural act, right? We had fire, you know, in prehistory, and we've only had air conditioning about 100 years. And so, there's absolutely power. It's in the air conditioning units, it's in the transformers, it's in the power distribution, it's in the processors, it's in the memories, it's in the networking. And more importantly, or I should say equally importantly, we don't tend to run our data centers at peak rate, because if you take queuing theory, you know you can't possibly, you run something at peak rate and then handle, coincidental Poisson arrivals. Okay, and so these things are often running at much less than their peak rate, and they often have less good efficiency at that level. So we're trying to make systems more proportional. And I think, by the way, non-volatile memory has a great thing, great promise, because the best way to save energy is to burn none when you're doing nothing. Okay, and if we can turn off ourselves for a few milliseconds, then there's, we can create the illusion that we're on and yet still save a lot of power. So there's just many opportunities there that have not been explored in the past because it wasn't a first order consideration. Yes.
So with your example of this chip that has this material that melts and cools it and so on, you bring up the point that, but traditionally, we've looked at the high end, and now we're talking about the exascale, and we looked at, pushing the technology to support the high end or reach the high end and then trickle down to the sensors, as you are pointing out in your example. This is a case that you mentioned is something that now we are looking at scale up, in the sense that the market be driven by, creating very power-efficient low-end and then scale up, because what you showed there can become a 3D also. You showed just one layer, but one can envision a 3D layer of sort of device, right?
So there were a couple questions there. One is, how does technology transfer? Is it from the highest supercomputing down, or might it go the other way? It's much more going the other way these days, right? Even IBM has recently built, supercomputers from their mobile parts. Big systems have to use actually mobile DRAM, even though it's less performant, because it saves a lot of power. And I think we're going to see much more of that. Exascale has some serious issues with Dennard scaling. You do the multiplication, and they can't possibly power those data centers unless we have some innovations. Regarding specifically applying computational sprinting to exascale, I think it's less appropriate, because in exascale you tend to do a computation that you want at scale, you want to run this to completion, and so you don't have the cooling down period. I don't remember the exact numbers, but this thing was running for seconds, right, or a minute. It wasn't running for an hour, transferring heat to melting.
You can turn it on and off.
It's possible. But it's most suited when you want a burst of speed, knowing that you have a duty cycle that's much less than one. Yes?
You advocated having identical processor, design specialized processors also for energy conservation. Would it affect adversely programming productivity and also character conservation?
Okay, so the question was, I advocated not just sort of homogeneous processors, but having specialized things, and wouldn't that affect the programming and correctness issues? Absolutely correct, right? I mean, that has been the limiting factor on using specialized devices to date. I mean, a lot of the programming environments, I guess I'm on tape, so I won't use colloquialism, are very bad. And, that's a perfect opportunity, I think, for research. It's not clear to me that they don't have to be as bad as they are. And, you know, we need abstractions, you know, to deal with that, abstractions that you can get the essence of how to use them without being, you know, overwhelmed by the details. And I think one of the things that's changed is, like, the so-called accelerators, like the iPad has a H.264 accelerator, which accelerates video decompression. And it's actually misnamed because it's not really important to do video decompression faster. I mean, you only want to do it as fast as you want to watch the frames. Okay, what that thing does actually is it does it at about the same speed for much, much less energy. And this is true for a lot of the so-called accelerators, that their improvement in the energy dimension, or I should say the power dimension, is greater than their performance dimension. And then energy, of course, is power times time.
Hi, Mark.
Yep.
So clearly, you know, we're in a data center world, and you mentioned that. But from this report, to what extent has, for example, storage architecture and I/O architecture been emphasized? It looks like mostly on the processors and the internet.
Yeah, I don't remember. Well, you're right in terms of there wasn't a lot of talk about it. There needs to be more talk. And I think there's lots of pressures for change now, right? Non-volatile memory technologies, particularly the ones that allow byte addressability, are going to blur the distinction between DRAM and storage. In fact, there's reasons why we're not going to be able to scale DRAM so effectively anymore. Right now, you can buy bigger DRAM packages, but actually they have two chips stacked on top of each other, so they're creating the illusion that the chip is bigger when it's not. I also think on the networking side, we're going to see lots of changes because there's lots of benefit to at least intra-data center networking reaching microsecond levels. Luis Barroso talks about the age of the microsecond, and I think he's right. And John Osterhout of Stanford makes some really good arguments for if we can make networking latency much, much lower, instead of having right now in the data center, you have these very structured computations like MapReduce, where you send everything this way and you send everything that way, and you know there's the number of communications in series is very small. And if we can be richer about it, we can do pointer-based data structures because we have lower latency. I gotta believe more things are possible. What they are, I don't know. All right, excellent question. So this was good. So we'll have less time for the specific research, but that's fine. So this is just an example of how you could do cross-cutting. In the end, what we're gonna see is that a small change to the operating system, a small change to the hardware, big benefit. Okay, so computer systems have been divided in layers since the beginning because we have to divide and conquer complexity, problem, algorithm. What happened to the colors here? These are supposed to be green. This is the software layers, hardware guys' view of the software layers. Then comes the instruction set architecture. Most of you probably wouldn't have had three layers down here, but I do. What we're going to look at is a small punch through on this layer, because when I say cross layers, I don't mean throw these layers away, because we still have to make these systems work. I'm saying let's not treat them as sacrosanct. Let's punch through some and get ourselves through the fallow period with some benefits. Okay, so Chuck Thacker in his Turing Award lecture a couple years ago said, virtual memory was invented in a time of scarcity. Is it still a good idea? We look at this, and as we see it, actually, it's often a good idea, but not always. And what we're going to look at is these big memory workloads where our analysis shows that something called TLB misses wastes about half the execution cycles. And this is a big deal. You say, well, maybe Google doesn't care if they waste half their execution cycles. But that's not true, because they could provide you the same service by buying half as many machines, or they could provide you with even more tailored ads. Okay, and what we're going to find is that paging is not needed for all this memory. And so we're going to have an idea, and we're calling it direct segments. And some of you in the room are saying, segments? I know about segments. That's an old idea. And that's true. And with these things, no TLB misses are possible, and we're going to eliminate 99% of that overhead. Okay, so let me just review virtual memory, since some of you may not have studied it since school. So each process has a virtual address space. It thinks it has the whole computer. The process often will have multiple threads these days. The processes are mapped to the physical memory. This mapping is a big thing. It's done in a hierarchical page table, which is so big that it has to be in memory. On x86, each translation could take 4 memory accesses in order to do your 1 memory access. This is obviously unacceptable, so we apply a very old idea called caching, and we put something that IBM, I guess, named a translation look-aside buffer, kind of an archaic name, which directly translates the virtual address to the physical address in a very small structure, 64 entries, say, that is so fast it finishes before the level 1 cache.
Because GLB has been around since page time,
right? Yeah, GLB since the 1960s. Okay, and so, but the challenge, if you find a translation, good, but if you don't find a translation, bad, because you have to wait for the translation. And while you can overlap a little bit, but pretty much you start waiting. Okay, so Federica's saying, come on, Mark, this is a 1960s problem. Why are you looking at it now? Well, it's because things change. Okay, so here's one change. Memory has gotten a million times bigger since 1980. So where you'd have a 1 megabyte memory, now you can have a 1 terabyte memory. You can buy, you can go to web, you know, don't do this during my talk, but you can go to web and you can buy a machine for 4 terabytes of memory. So it's physical memory. This is not the disk, this is the memory. Okay, and so there's that. And then there's a lot of big data workloads which like to access a lot of memory, and they store information for many users. You can imagine Facebook, you know, different users are all over the place in this memory, okay? And so you don't have great locality. Now, how is this translation done? This little thing that's next to the cache, it's called a translation look-aside buffer. So each core on your chip has one of these things, and this is how big it is. On Intel machines, and this is how it's changed in the last 10 years. Okay? So 72, 64, 96, 100. So this is essentially no change while the memory has gotten a million times bigger. Okay? And we have these low access server workloads. So that's why we're revisiting this. Memory size up a million, TLB size not changed, low locality, problem. Okay? So we did some experiments. I'll cover this quickly, I guess. Well, maybe we'll do it. So this is the specific TLB sizes on this machine, and we only had 96 gigabytes of memory because, you know, we're on an NSF grant, which is generous, but not that generous. So no 4-terabyte machine. We're using hardware performance counters because this is something that runs for hours. Okay, and we got these workloads. So Graph 500 simulates a social graph, which can be anything from friends to terrorist networks. Memcached is a key-value store. MySQL is a database running TPCC, a couple of NASH parallel benchmarks, and GUPS is a micro-benchmark that does sort of pointer-chasing modeling, very poor locality that agencies such as the NSA are very interested in. Okay, and here is the performance loss assuming 4 kilobyte pages, which is the base page size that most systems use, and you see the numbers are gigantic, 50% here, 10%, 5%. Remember, 5% is a big deal because you could buy 5% fewer computers. Now, the systems do support some ability to use bigger pages, which makes each TLB entry more effective. And this helps a bunch. And there's even limited support for 1 gigabyte pages, which usually helps but doesn't always help, and there's reasons for this which I won't go into. Okay. And so the net result is that there's significant overhead from page virtual memory. You can quibble with my exact numbers. And I think it's going to get worse because memories are still getting bigger, and we're talking about mapping non-volatile memory into the address space. Okay, and so what's going to happen to these TLBs then? Okay, wouldn't it be nice if we had a way to have the overhead be these purple bars? Okay, and since you can't see these purple bars, I got the arrows above them. Okay, and that is what our idea is going to do. And I'll just give you the hand wave of the idea in the interest of time. Okay, so first of all, we also try to practice the scientific method, and so we have hypotheses, and we do analysis before we propose a new design. So let me show you, talk about the analysis first, because in some sense, the identification of the problem is more important than our particular solution, because next year somebody may come up with a better solution. Okay, so Memcached is a good poster child. So this is, it's a key value store. was used by companies like Facebook. Almost all the memory shown in green over there, doesn't look green, is just a read-write anonymous memory storing key values that Facebook is matching on. And then there's a little bit of memory that holds network state in the operating system. You know, network state in the operating system, it might be 3 gigabytes. That's a little bit of memory these days, even on a 96-gigabyte machine, never mind a 4-terabyte machine. Okay? So what did we do? We looked at this and said, well, virtual memory was invented to do certain things. You know, how is it being used? Okay? The reason it was originally invented was to do swapping, which is transferring information between disk and memory transparently. Okay, so this allowed you to run a job that was bigger than your physical memory. Well, these workloads don't use swapping. Why don't they use swapping? It's because their workload is sized to the physical memory available. If you're going to allocate this key value store, you don't allocate it any size you want. You allocate what fits in memory, and then you manage yourself going to disk. So you don't want it to swap. It may swap a teeny bit, but that's a bad thing. There's also issue with protection. And we'll go into right now. And then there's also fragmentation. So paging was done to manage fragmentation well. All pieces were interchangeable. As you swap something in, you could put something back. If you stopped using something, blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out these workloads don't operate like those workloads of old. If you go to the next slide, what they do is they allocate, this is a 25-minute run, so that wasn't simulation. They basically allocate a big data structure, so this is allocating gigabytes over time in seconds. They allocate a big data structure and they hold. They don't give it back. So basically, you're not using this feature of virtual memory, fragmentation minimization, either. Okay, but there's other parts of your memory that you are using the full features of virtual memory. You have read-only code, you have guard pages on the stack, blah, blah, blah. And so it's not needed for most of the memory, but for some of the memory, okay? And so our idea is basically to say, hey, let's keep paging because 10% overheads are not enough that you're going to rewrite the whole operating system, but let's use it selectively. So we're going to use it when we need it, and when we don't need it, why don't we have a real simple address translation that provides you some basic protection, but you can't have a TLB miss on it. Okay, and that is our idea. So at the pictorial level, this represents the virtual address space and the physical address space, and these are pages that are mapped. We are going to have this big region, which Memcached is going to use for its key value store, which has a base register and a limit register and an offset register, and we're going to translate everything directly with no possibility of a TLB miss. Okay, and why are we doing this? Well, that's all that was needed to make these workloads run well. There may be more complicated mechanisms that you could use, but I sort of believe in Occam's razor, try to come up with the simplest mechanism that works. All right, so we're going to have to skip this, but basically the hardware is relatively simple. This blue thing over here is actually 100 entries or more. This is only 2 comparators, so they're not the size. But basically, we give the address to the old hardware and the new hardware, and if it's within the new hardware's range, the new hardware takes over with no TLB misses, and if it's on the other side, the paging hardware works. Okay.
Can you share the cross processors? You're going to consider those
eventually. The segments can be shared across processors. Yes. Across processes.
Oh.
Okay. The segments are actually locked down in physical memory. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip most of the details here. I guess the biggest thing with this idea is we're assuming that this direct segment is locked down in physical memory. So you either have to allocate it at the beginning, which is actually reasonable for a lot of jobs. Like if these are the cluster that's running search at Bing, they're going to know their memory sizes. Or, but memory compaction is also possible. You can copy things around because we're talking about long-running jobs here. All right, let's just skip this. Segmentation is not a new idea. I'm not that ignorant of the literature. But there's a key difference here is that we don't do it on top of paging. We sort of do it instead of paging for some addresses. but we keep paging for compatibility because we don't reinvest everything, and we don't expose it to the application. So there's no two-dimensional address space. It's completely linear addresses. In fact, you only have to either just do a flag to malloc saying, I want my anonymous regions to use this thing, or you can just identify the process as doing it. So there's almost no change to the application to get all these benefits. Okay, so our methodology, let's skip that. So these are the results that I showed before, and this is the benefit. And why do we get this benefit? It's because this percentage of the former TLB misses land in the region where the direct segment is. Okay, and so yes, you have memory in the operating system and network buffers, but it doesn't take that many TLB misses because it's small and has good locality, whereas these guys have great deal of trouble. It has some limitations, so I have more years on my grant, and we'll stop there. Okay, so I have a little bit left, but I can take a few questions on this work. If there are any, yes.
Have you identified the direct segment? Is it only architectural compatible system?
So how do you identify the direct segment? So this requires a small change to the hardware and a small change to the operating system. The operating system can choose, for example, to say that these processes are ones that want to have a direct segment. And then all anonymous read-write memory allocations go to the direct segment. Or you can just have a flag on malloc saying, I want it allocated normally, I want it allocated to the direct segment. I skipped some of this, but you can think of the direct segment as like a variable-sized big page. It's pretty invisible. And if the operating system wants to not do it or convert back to paging, it can't. So if you want to actually swap the information, you can convert it back to paging and swap it to disk.
And maybe it's exposed to the programmer. You know,
it's not exposed to the programmer. You just know that your anonymous read-write memory won't take very many TLB misses. It's just, I mean, you still have the same linear address space. So if you think about how much are big pages exposed to the programmer, whether you're backed by 4K or 2 meg, not very much. And it's a similar thing here. Yes?
But I guess, following up on that, isn't there some implication for the program? Because this is a pretty substantial difference, right? If I make a mistake and I say, well, instead of doing direct addressing, I say, well, let's just change everything, that's going to make a big difference to my performance. And I guess why I'm asking this is, in addition to the implication for practice, isn't there going to be a big implication for education as well?
Maybe I'm marketing this as two different. It's not that big of a change. So first of all, well, for example, let's say you allocated all your memory in this area, and it was mapped by a direct segment, and then you decided that you need to make this page in the middle read only. The operating system just converts the direct segment back to paging, and marks it read only, and you. Or maybe it can keep a direct segment beside it. So you lose the performance benefits, but there isn't a correctness abstraction difference.
No, correctness, but I mean, if we're talking about difference in terms of performance, it could be substantial.
Right, but I look at this as an opportunity, right? It's like, if you don't do this, it's simple. If you choose to use this, you probably want to think a little bit. I mean, you do want to think, by the way, to use your big memory stuff should be contiguous in the virtual address space. So you want to think about it a little. But if you fail to think about it, you're no worse off than you were before. You just haven't availed yourself of this opportunity.
So we find mostly in an environment where I have shared data and local data. Certainly the local data will go into direct segment. But what happens to the shared data?
So the shared data versus local data is probably too long a question for right now. The segments can be shared. It's just like, you can think of it as a one variable size page. So if you want to share some or all of it, you can. Yeah, they can be written. Yeah, some of this stuff, by the way, is reflecting what x86 does, and there are certainly architectures from IBM and HP, and Itanium was another one that has a lot of features like this. But The prevalent architectures out there I like to affect what really happens are x86 and ARM. Okay, so let me, in the interest of time here, I'm going to skip the next segment on saving TLB power. Okay, and so we didn't talk about saving TLB power, but we have some techniques for saving TLB power. And I just want to close with a thank you to NSF. So my students and colleagues and I thank you. You've been my principal support since 1988, and I know you don't get thanks very often because, like, if somebody funds you, if you fund somebody, I'm sure they think, well, that's because they have merit. And if you don't fund somebody, that's because you're an idiot. Okay, I just want to say thank you for all the funding. I've taught 1,000 students, 15 or so PhDs who now have generated 40 PhD progeny. It started with a Presidential Young Investigator Award in 1989 and continues with the grant that supports this work. And I've worked hard to make the tax dollars go further, extracting donations from these companies, many of whom I've outlasted. Here are the grants. 19 of them over 26 years. So thank you. All right, further questions?
Yeah, Mark. My impression is that on modern machines, typically the latency to main memory, if you have a cache fault, so say you're working on a very large hash table like mcached for Facebook, it's much bigger than the cache, so you're going to go directly to main. You're going to take a cache fault almost every time. And my impression is this is about 250 clocks on a modern processor. Is that correct?
So the observation was if you take a miss all the way to memory, it's long, maybe 250 clocks. That's a larger number than I would have picked, but that's the right order.
So,
The thing is you have to have the translation before you can even go out for it. So the translation is serialized in front of it.
Okay. But in typical typical algorithm design, stores and fetches used to be cheap compared to arithmetic and things like this. Now they seem to be fabulously expensive.
So the observation is that stores and fetches used to be cheap relative to arithmetic. That's absolutely true. I mean, a memory reference like these are 100 times more expensive than a floating point division. Okay, and it's getting worse, and that's time. Okay, when you talk about energy, it's even greater. I don't have the exact numbers, but Steve Keckler has a very nice slide on the energy of a floating point multiply add versus getting the operands from a local store to a little bit further to off chip. And the energy is tremendous to move the data, and the computation is very efficient. So in some ways, programming models should assume computation is free, and it's all about communication and storage.
Has this been reflected in algorithm design classes? An algorithm?
There's algorithm research in this, but I don't think it's really made it big into the mainstream of undergraduate education. And also, undergraduate education still focuses mostly on sequential algorithms. And going forward, algorithms are almost always going to be parallel. Well, people argue about that, but I think so.
Any questions from the line?
At this time, if you'd like to ask an audio question, please press star 1, and you'll be announced prior to asking. Again, to ask an audio question, please press star 1. One moment for the first question. At this time, I show no audio questions.
Any other questions from the room? Okay, Mark thanked us, but let's thank Mark one more time for all your work and for what was, I think, a very stimulating talk. So, Mark, thank you very much. The next SIDES Distinguished Lecture will be January 23rd with Beth Minot, so I encourage everybody to try and attend that. Thank you all.
Thank you. Today's conference has ended. All participants may now disconnect.